This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. It has been called NAFTA on steroids. The Trans-Pacific Partnership is a trade deal under negotiation by 12 nations, including the United States, Australia, Japan, Singapore. Proponents of the deal say it will ensure smoother trade between the U.S. and Pacific Rim nations and result in more sales for American businesses. Opponents say it will cost American jobs and further erode our nation's falling standard of living. Joining us now to talk about it is Corey Krupp. She is Associate Professor at Duke University Sanford School of Public Policy. Welcome, Corey. Good to have you here.
Thank you.
Also with us, Mary B. McMillan, Secretary-Treasurer of North Carolina's AFL-CIO. Mary B., good to have you.
Thank you,
Frank.
Corey,
you're in favor of this Trans-Pacific Partnership. Why? What benefits do you think it'll bring?
Well, this is the culmination, or what is hoped to be a culmination, of a lot of issues that have been discussed at the WTO for many years that are beyond tariffs. I mean, most free trade agreements are about reducing tariffs, and this one is trying to go a lot further since tariffs are already really low. It's addressing issues of state-owned enterprises and intellectual property protection and competition policy, all kinds of things that affect the ability of firms to compete. And since this region of the world is probably the biggest trader, it's important for the U.S. to be at the table. And I think this kind of a trade agreement is a good idea, and it's what a lot of other countries are negotiating all over the world because the WTO rounds have stalled.
Mary B., you wrote an op-ed in the News and Observer that criticized this deal. Why?
We believe that the TPP is going to follow in the footsteps of NAFTA and CAFTA and other trade deals, and that we're going to continue to see the loss of good-paying American jobs as a result. You know, since NAFTA, we've lost 1 in 4 U.S. manufacturing jobs. Here in North Carolina, we've lost over 375,000 manufacturing jobs since NAFTA. That's about 46% of our entire manufacturing sector. And I've seen firsthand how trade can devastate the state. I grew up in Hickory, North Carolina, in the foothills. It was once the furniture capital of the country. Now those furniture factories and upholstery plants are boarded up, casualties of NAFTA and CAFTA. I saw Hickory on the front page of the Washington Post a couple years ago because that metro area had more workers that qualified for trade adjustment assistance funds than anywhere else in the country. And it's not just those workers who now are earning low wages at Walmart. It's the whole town's economy that's been devastated. It wasn't just the furniture factories that closed. It was the diner down the street. It was the trucking company that used to haul that nice American-made furniture to showrooms around the country. It was the clothing store downtown. Business after business closed, home after home vacant with for sale signs. You know, that means that the tax revenue is going down. There's less money for schools and for the infrastructure. So unemployment, low wages, is devastating for the whole economy. And that's why these trade deals are so bad.
Corey, what about that? Free trade means race to the bottom, lower wages, and job loss.
No, I disagree with that. And I do recognize that a lot of manufacturing jobs have been lost in the United States since 1990. And a big chunk of it has been since China joined the WTO in 2001. China's not part of this trade agreement. There's only 2 developing countries that are of the 12. We already have free trade agreements with half of them. Bigger part of this is issues like intellectual property protection and state-owned enterprises. I mean, and trade and services, which is where the U.S. dominates. We are by far the biggest trader, exports and imports, of this entire group of countries. This is a better deal for us because we need more transparency and disclosure. We need clear rules under which our companies can compete abroad, ways that they can ensure their intellectual property isn't stolen and then used to create competitors, doing something about the anti-competitive behavior that they face over there. That's something that we have an interest in that will help protect our firms and help make them more competitive. And staying away from the table because of what happened in the past isn't a way forward.
One of the things that interfere with competition, of course, are wages and also regulations, health and safety regulations. To what extent will this agreement limit the right of governments to impose those kind of regulations and safeguards for its workers and its population?
It doesn't limit their right to make health and safety regulations. That's still part of every country's sovereign right. Okay. Some of it is looking at the cumbersomeness of some of these rules that every single country has a whole different procedure, and trying to find a way to streamline the process. One set of documents that all agencies can use to make decisions, clarify what's being required. I think one of the things that we see is that a lot of small and medium enterprises can't access global markets because of the red tape and the bureaucracy. And part of what they're discussing in this agreement is ways to streamline that and facilitate more trade.
What about that, Mary B? Would just streamlining make it easier for small businesses right here in this country who would then hire more people if they had more business abroad?
No, past history shows that trade agreements don't do that. And, you know, Corey's right that this agreement is about so much more than trade intellectual property. It really, when you look at it, it's really a witch's brew of provisions that are toxic to workers, consumers, and our whole economy. It would ban Buy America, Buy Local provisions. It would flood our markets with unsafe food products. It would roll back financial regulations that we fought so hard for in the Dodd-Frank Act. And it would allow foreign corporations to challenge other countries' laws before these tribunals and demand taxpayer settlements if these laws infringe on their ability to earn future profits. This trade deal is not a good thing for workers or consumers. And I think that as the American people learn more about it, they're going to become outraged.
I guess that's one of the questions. We can't learn more about it because much of it has been done in secret. So we don't really know too much about this, Corey. Is that right?
Yeah, Frank, you are right. A lot of the negotiations, they've been going on since 2003, this started. And they've had 19 different working group meetings to work on this. It has 29 chapters. It's massive. And I think part of the reason we're seeing so many more of these kinds of regional trade agreements being negotiated is, you know, when you have the entire membership of the WTO, 185 countries trying to reach agreement on all these issues, you just don't get anywhere. So that's why they try to do it in smaller groups. And there has been progress. For one example, the government procurement agreement that the WTO has, it lays out the rules under which governments have to list or open up bidding on transport projects and communications. It doesn't compel a country to hire or open up its markets to unsafe foreign food or spying, for example. But it does allows firms to know what the rules are and to have access to the rules under which they can compete for these projects instead of just being shoved aside by the favored local firms.
What would happen, though, if you were brought before? There has to be some governing body, right, some tribunal to which you were brought. If I have an objection, so if I don't like what you're doing, even if I have unsafe food and the country says, you can't bring that in, well, you've proven that this is not a good process, you can't come in, and now I take you to court, what happens in the meantime? What gets held up while this any kind of judicial process takes place?
Well, there's a dispute settlement panel that has members that look at the evidence from both sides, makes a preliminary ruling. It tries to first reach an agreement with the countries that have the dispute. And if that fails, then they do an investigation. And at the end of it, the offending party who's found guilty of violating the trade rules has to either cease, or if they say, no, I'm not going to cease, then the country that filed the case gets to impose tariffs on them.
Corey, what about this? Mary B., the idea of secrecy, the fact that we don't know too many of the details about this and just what would be allowed, what governments would and would not be allowed to impose on their corporations or people doing business with them?
Well, the folks that do know what's in this agreement are over 600 corporate advisors who have been at the table. You know, even Congress didn't see much of this until very recently. And I think that the reason it's being kept secret is that they know that the American people will be outraged when they learn some of these provisions. It's going to jack up prescription drug prices. It'll make it more difficult to have generic drugs on the market.
Well, wait, let me stop you there. Now, let's work on a detail. How do you know? What provision does that?
I mean, there have been documents leaked out that talk about that there will be longer monopoly patents on drugs, that there will be new systems to determine drug formularies, which could impact our ability to negotiate decent prices for Medicare drug recipients. All of these provisions, this things about financial regulation that we've seen and what's been leaked out, that would ban too big to fail provisions that we got passed in regulations, that would do away with Wall Street speculation taxes on these risky financial services and products that got us into this financial crisis in the first place. I really think what we have seen so far from this agreement epitomizes the corporate greed and failed economic policies that created this recession and that have created such massive income inequality in this country.
Corey?
No way. No, we haven't seen what we've seen in the pharmaceutical side is an appeal to allow us to protect our drugs, biologics, for example, for 12 years, right? We want our same copyright and trademark law where you can have a copyright that lasts for the author's age plus 70 years. Under most agreements now with TRIPS, it's 50 years. So we're asking for a slight extension, right? It's the idea that somehow the U.S. is going to be imposing its will and that the corporate greed is going to make sure that, you know, we dominate the world is pretty laughable.
Well, it's not the U.S. And I mean, I think that's the thing you have to make clear. The United States doesn't trade with anybody. U.S. corporations do. And so the question is, what do the people, what right do the people have to regulate those corporations? And if you agree to an overarching agreement, a treaty, which limits the right of the people to say, no, I want this provision. I want that to expire after a certain number of years. I think that's costly to us. If it doesn't, you limit my right as a democracy and give it to a corporation that then has negotiated the deal. That's the United States doesn't trade with anybody, right?
Right. No, the gist of doing trade deals and trade rules is to have rules, right? Have rules under which you operate. And the countries that negotiate these rules, it doesn't compel a sovereign nation to pass laws that they disagree with. What you can't do is penalize another country's goods just because they're coming from a different country. So you can't ban something based on the fact that it's being traded. That's discriminatory. Right?
What rules do you think, Mary B., would do that? Do you think in any way that sovereignty is impinged on, or is this just allowing these companies to bring their products into the country if they're deemed safe?
I mean, you have Chevron challenging Ecuador's laws because they tried to impose fines on them for polluting the Amazon rainforest. You have Eli Lilly challenging patent laws in Canada, saying that they're infringing upon these companies' abilities to earn profits. I think it's a dangerous road that we're going down. And I think that it does infringe on our democracy. And it certainly, I think, endangers our rights as consumers and workers. And I think that we should be very concerned about this, concerned about the process and concerned about what's in this agreement.
You know, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce is very much in favor of this. And one of the things they wrote in their paper in support of this agreement is that over the last two decades, the Asian Pacific region's middle class grew by 2 billion people. Mm-hmm. We have the United States, our middle class is shrinking over the same period when trade agreements were in effect. So it seems to me the Chamber of Commerce is saying what's good for Asia is not good for the United States when it comes to trade agreements. I don't think they meant that, but that's how I read this. Their middle class has grown. The American middle class has shrunk. Spending power for the American middle class. You may still technically be in it, but your spending power right now, the median income is $51,000, and it's the same as it was in 89. You've lost $600 in spending power.
Right. Yeah, we've had a terrible recession, and we had a housing bubble that burst. We had a lot of people live way beyond their means and borrow, and now they're digging out from under debt. Asia did not have that. Asia pulled a lot of people out of non-participation in labor force or rural subsistence agriculture into paid work. And so their development, they pulled a lot of people out of poverty. Fact is, we belong now to a very globalized labor force, and there's nothing in any trade agreement that's going to stop that now. And we have to deal with what is, not what we wish it was like.
What about that, Mary B.? This is the world we're living in. We can't live and stick our head in the sand and pretend that it's all going to go away.
I mean, how low are we going to go in this race to the bottom before we realize that workers are consumers and taxpayers? I mean, we need to come to the realization that what's good for workers is good for business. And I don't think that this agreement's good for workers here. I don't think it's good for workers in Asia. The labor movement would support real fair trade that would raise the living standards for workers here in America and abroad. We will continue to oppose vehemently agreements like this that will continue the race to the bottom for workers around the globe. We want to see trade agreements that will allow American companies to export more goods. We do not want trade agreements that export more jobs.
Thank you both for being on the program. Mary B. McMillan is Secretary Treasurer of the North Carolina AFL-CIO. Corey Krupp, Associate Professor at Duke University's Sanford School of Public Policy. Thank you both for being
on the
program.
Thank you, Frank.
To read Mary B.'s op-ed and for more information on this, go to our website, stateofthings.org. We get a glimpse of what makes ordinary homes extraordinary in their home movies. Stay tuned.